The E-12 Education Finance Committee will come to order. And first we have Senator File 1007, Senator Fishbach. And welcome, Senator Fishbach and superintendents. Members, you also have a fiscal sheet, and that should be in your file as well. So, Senator Fishbach?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Senate File 1007 is pretty simple. What it would do is allow those districts that are in statutory operating debt to move that excess debt levy money over into their general fund. And they wouldn't do it, they would leave the 5%, so that would still be there. So it would be anything in excess of the 5% to help them get out of statutory operating debt. And I do have superintendents here with me who can probably tell the story better than I can.
Okay, thank you, Senator Fishbach. Who wants to go first?
Good morning.
Name for the record, please.
My name is John Hawes, and I'm the superintendent of Holdingford, which is a district of about 1,000 students, about 25 miles northwest of St. Cloud. And I became superintendent there in July. Found out I kind of walked into a mess as far as finances go. The district is currently about 8% in SOD, about $560,000. So we are looking at making some rather large reductions. There's a number of reasons, I think, why the district got into SOD, and those are things that we are dealing with. We've set up some committees, are very determined that we will only run positive budgets from now on, so we can not only get out of SOD, but also maintain a good fund balance. And the reason this bill would help our district is because not only do we have to balance our budget, of course, but we have to get out of that $500,000 hole, and that would allow us to maintain some of the programs that we currently have. Holdingford has a reputation of doing very, very well on MCAs. In fact, we have students move into our district that look at our test scores, which is a good thing, and we would like to be able to continue to do that. The other thing that I would like to mention is because of funding right now, Holdingford receives about 82% of the average per pupil that schools in Minnesota do. So we feel like even though we're in SOD, you know, we have tried to use money as well as we can, and this bill would definitely help us get out of that hole. Thank you.
Thank you, Superintendent. Superintendent Lester?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Keith Lester, Superintendent of Schools in Brooklyn Center, and I appreciate being here. I'll approach a little bit differently. Back in December, I met with some representatives from the Department of Education to talk about Brooklyn Center's plight. We've had a rather drastic change in demographics in many ways over the years, and we've been in SOD. It says since 2001, but as I look at things, I wonder if we got out earlier. But the department authorized and paid for a fiscal analysis of our district. And the number one conclusion that was given in this report, and once again, we didn't pay for this, but I was happy to see it, said while overspending was a major contributor to the initial deficit, insufficient revenue was a factor in more recent years. And there are a number of factors. You're hearing a lot about the cross-subsidy. He felt that the formula frozen in 2004-05, we weren't able to catch up adequately. And as our population of more needy students, is the term he used, has increased, our costs have increased, and we haven't been able to catch up. This transfer would provide that opportunity for us to take at least a little bit larger step to catch up. He also commented that we have begun to take the kinds of steps we need to correct the problems we have. I believe that we have a much clearer vision of our district financial status, as well as a plan to get out of statutory operating debt. This additional help by making this transfer would be critical as we look at cutting $600,000 to $700,000 next year. would be a great help. So we'd appreciate your consideration of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Superintendent. Now, just to kind of bring members up to speed, the legislation is a statewide legislation. So this would pertain to all districts that are currently in statutory operating debt.
Mr. Chair, yes. And I think on these, I don't know if you've had the full fiscal note, but on the second page of the fiscal note, there are some of the school districts they mention on that second page. Although, you know, there's a couple of qualifiers, Mr. Chair, that they would have to meet. You know, they would have to have more than 5% in that account in order and be an SOD. And I am assuming that that $10,000 is, since the bill, Mr. Chair, is statewide, that reflects the statewide numbers.
Mr. Chairman?
The fiscal note is it's over $1 million.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I've got a fiscal note that says something different. Mine is dated 2/28/07.
Mr. Nauman?
Mr. Chairman, I think there might be a little confusion here. The fiscal note does indeed carry a $10,000 annual aid cost, but of course this committee has to be concerned about the aid side and the levy side. And the levy impact of this bill is $1 million on a statewide basis. And that's in the fiscal note under the local expenditure and or revenue formula.
Mr. Nauman, do you have, just to kind of refresh people's memories or bring people up to speed, the statutory law relating to SOD, could you just refresh our memories?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. When a school district has a net negative balance of more than 2.5% of their general fund, they are said to be in statutory operating debt, and certain conditions then apply. School districts must develop a plan to get out of statutory operating debt. That plan must be approved by the department, so the school districts in conjunction with the department have to then work together to come up with a plan. And that plan may include assumed referendum passage. It may also include some adjustments for potential fund transfers. And then I think that sort of covers it, Mr. Chairman. I think the concern is that you've just recently looked at the statutory operating debt report for the most recent year, and we do in that report carry the number of years that a school district has been in SOD, and in some cases it's quite a number of years.
The question maybe would be for Mr. Melcher, if Mr. Melcher's here. Maybe just move in another chair up there. That's fine. Could you just bring us up to speed as to if a school district goes into SOD, then the department works out or the school district works out a plan with the department. So how do some schools remain in SOD for a fairly lengthy amount of time, some as long as since 1996? Can you explain that?
My name is Tom Melcher. I'm with the Department of Education. And generally, when we're working with school districts that are in statutory operating debt, we try to work out an arrangement whereby the district can get out of debt within a 3-year period. However, there are situations where the school district's expenditures may grow at a more rapid rate than they projected at the time that they worked on the plan, or perhaps they were planning on having an operating referendum levy passed as a part of the plan, and then it doesn't pass. If that situation occurs, then we require the district to submit a revised plan. And we have run into situations where school districts that are in statutory operating debt have had some difficulty in terms of projecting their expenditures or their revenues. Sometimes these are districts that are declining in enrollment, and their plan may be based on one level of expectation as far as the number of students, and they decline more rapidly than anticipated. In some cases, it becomes a kind of a cyclical thing where you make budget cuts and you lose students to open enrollment, and that leads to more students being lost to open enrollment because the quality of the program has been reduced.
Would that be the explanation for, let's say, Greenway, which has been in statutory operating debt since 1996?
Mr. Chairman, I think in the case of Greenway, there have been a series of plans where they've done a plan virtually every year, and there have been continued problems in terms of the level of budget cuts not meeting the expectations that were set in the plan, and then the district coming back and trying a new approach the following year. That they've been in the SOD longer than just about anybody, and it's been a difficult challenge for them to get out.
Do you have any recommendations?
Chairman, I think with a bill like this, certainly you have to weigh the fiscal impact against certainly this would have a benefit to those districts attempting to get out of
statutory operating debt from a technical perspective. If you move forward with a bill like this, I would encourage you to clarify whether a district that's close to being out of statutory operating debt, whether they would still be allowed to make the full transfer, or whether they would only be able to transfer enough money to get them to that 2.5% limit. In other words, if your 2.5% was $1 million and you were just $1,100,000 in the hole, let's say, and you had $200,000 in debt excess, could you transfer the full amount to get you beyond what it took to get out of statutory operating debt, or would you be limited to that amount? That's one kind of technical thing that I think needs to be clarified. I think this bill would be a benefit to these districts in statutory operating debt. The other side of it, of course, is the impact on the statewide targets for taxes. And also there's a kind of a concern that if this is an ongoing procedure, it might make districts a little bit less concerned about getting in statutory operating debt because they have another vehicle for getting out of statutory operating debt. So I know in the past when we've had legislation that has attempted to help districts in statutory operating debt, it's been limited to districts that are in statutory operating debt at a particular point in time in order to avoid creating a kind of an incentive to not worry so much about whether you go into debt because you've got a way of being bailed out.
Does the legislation kind of obscure the integrity of the funds? You have the debt redemption fund. At least the way I've often looked at it is that's the integrity of that fund is not necessarily for general operating.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the only reason that a school district would have an excess balance in the debt redemption fund is if they did have a building program and they were paying their debt at debt service and they're generating excess funds in the debt redemption account. So the normal process is if you have generated this excess in the debt redemption fund, because each year you're required to levy 105% of what you need to ensure that the bonds will be paid, that in effect what you're doing is creating a situation where some districts in statutory operating debt would be able to benefit by this if they happen to be districts that are also engaged in the process of school construction and paying for debt, and other districts in statutory operating debt would not be able to cover this. So if you look at the fiscal note, you'll see that some districts would get a lot of help and other districts would not get help in terms of getting out of statutory operating debt simply because of where they sit in terms of their debt service fund. And if this bill were to be enacted, I think the department would have a bit more of a challenge in terms of monitoring the fund balance levels in school district debt redemption funds as well, because they would be
some incentive there to increase the size of the debt excess in order to be able to transfer the money to the general fund.
Okay. Any other questions that members have? And I asked the superintendents, what is your plan to get out of statutory operating debt, or what is your plan to get out of statutory operating debt?
Well, I'll start while you're getting situated. Keith Lester, thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I would want to highlight some of the questions that came up earlier I'd like to comment on. Sometimes the situation for Brooklyn Center is we've had a levy defeated four times in the last 15 months, 16 months, and the second time it was defeated, we also lost an existing levy. So that's part of our issue. As far as an incentive, I suppose it depends on the district. I don't see it, because what has happened to us is we got into SOD, we got behind, and then when our expenditures, because of our population change, a number of things, increased, we weren't able to keep up. We had the cross-subsidy and those things. So that's part of the issue. Our plan is to cut significantly in the next 2 years. We think that we can get out in the next 3 years. This would be a big help in that, or excuse me, in the next 2 years would be a big help. Our plan is to go back to the voters. We haven't had a great deal of luck, but we're working with the department and a number of other groups to try to find ways to pass a levy. But in the meantime, we're just working hard at trimming costs. Cutting our administrative team will be down to about five of us by the end of this year, and trying to save there so that we cut as little as possible in the classroom. And then we will have to cut teachers too, which, as Mr. Melcher mentioned, when you start cutting programs, then students don't come, and when students don't come, you lose revenue, and it becomes a cyclical thing that you really can't catch up from. So we're hopeful that this is just one little, very small piece in the scheme of things for us to be able to get out.
Superintendent Haas.
Again, John Haas, Holdingford. Our plan, again, is to get out of SOD in 2 years. Our budget for next year includes over $300,000 in cuts, which is about 4% of our budget. We are trying to cut impacting the classroom as little as possible. One way we are doing that is we are cutting back to three sections in every subject. Currently, we're kind of in between a three-section school and a four-section school. And that way we can maintain program because, like Mr. Lester said, we are very aware that if you cut program, you lose students. We are able to do that the first year of our plan. The second year, we are currently projecting about $260,000 in further cuts. That is the year that will really hurt our program because we'll have to cut programs in order to maintain that. And again, we're looking every possible way we can. We're looking at if it would help us to contract for buses. It looks like we can save some dollars there. We're looking at our insurance plan. We're looking at extended contracts. We've cut all our extended contracts for our media people and our counselors and all those type of people. We're finding a few thousand dollars here and there, and again, this would be a piece that would help us because we would have that would be $100,000 less that, in our case, that we would have to cut. I'd also like to respond to one more thing. I don't know of really any district that wants to be an SOD. I mean, it's a public relations nightmare. With the people, your constituents, and they, of course, look at you in a way that, why can't you manage your money? And so I see the point that it could possibly be where districts would go into SOD just to access this money. It's such a public relations nightmare that I'm pretty sure districts wouldn't look at that as an avenue in the future. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm sure that... I guess I'd hate to be the superintendent of some of these districts that have been in for SOD for over 10 years.
Yes.
Kind of a perennial nightmare. Okay. Is there any other questions that members have? I know it's... I do have a little bit of a worry about the integrity of funds and the problem with making it you know, just a general statewide approach, because I, you know, it would be the whole purpose of the debt redemption fund is that it's for a specific purpose. Now, a lot of people don't understand why you have to levy 105%, but the purpose for 105% is to be sure you actually cover the debt. And then once that debt's covered, that's supposed to go back to the taxpayers in, you know, in property tax reductions. If you have no reason to send that back in property tax reductions, it becomes a kind of a natural that you're going to want that money into the system. But Senator Bonhoff?
Mr. Chair, as someone who represents the school district that has the biggest amount of SOD on this list, I can tell you it is such a horrible experience for all of the community. I get, you know, email after email from parents saying, isn't there any way that even we can pay more because we're at the cap and we're closing schools? And my son even said he doesn't want to go to Hopkins anymore because his classes are so big that he tunes out. And so I think that, in fact, if we somehow had a way to even ask our citizens, they might tell you that they'd prefer to do whatever they can to get out of SOD because it is such a painful experience. But I understand your concern, and we don't want to tell our taxpayers one thing and then do another. So if there was some way to do this in a forthright manner, thank you.
Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand your concerns also, but I'd like to move Senate File 1007 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Okay, Senator Wergen moves that Senate File 1007 be laid on the table for possible inclusion into the omnibus education bill. All those, any other discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much for considering this. I think it would go a long way to help districts in SOD.
Thank you very much.
Senator Fischbach and superintendents. Senator Bonhoff. Did I give you your... Senator Bonhoff, this is Senate File 1167, and that was on the schedule last week, and we didn't quite get to it, so we're back to it. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to my testifiers, particularly Superintendent Oslin, who came back to be with us again this morning. I will let the people who I'm with this morning talk more about the details of the bill, but to create some kind of a context for why I'm here presenting this bill, even though we understand that our resources are limited, I felt that it was important to let you know the background. As everyone knows, and we're going to be hearing later this morning, PS Minnesota was an approach where, for the first time ever, the communities came together from all the different parts of our state to say that it is important that we work together to do what's best for education. And in doing so, they had different parts in the formula that were reflective of the needs of their particular constituencies. And one of the things that I found interesting is that the part of the new recommended PS Minnesota formula that was important to the districts in the metro and suburban parts of our state is the one piece that is currently not reflected at all in the formula. The other things that were recommended in the PS Minnesota approach, like increasing sparsity and giving more for transportation, those things are currently in the formula, but PS Minnesota changes the way that we're approaching it. There is currently nothing in the formula that does anything for the increased cost that it requires to run school districts in these particularly metro suburban areas. So this bill lifts directly the language from the PS Minnesota report and says that we are going to take care of that piece. We are going to do something for those school districts. And so with that, I will turn it over first to Mr. Kroomquist.
Welcome, Mr. Kroomquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members, and thank you, Senator Bonner, for carrying this legislation. We very much appreciate Senator Bonner bringing this forward. And we will try to be brief, Mr. Chairman, really for two reasons. We know you heard this really earlier in the year when you had the PS Minnesota report, and so it is, it's really a kind of a review of that. And also, we also know your budget target, and it's probably going to make it a little bit difficult for you to make a lot of progress on this on this bill this year. And we know that Senator Salzman has another bill coming up soon that would actually refer this issue to study, to further study. But we did think it was important to at least get it on the table and to begin the discussion and the dialogue about this issue. It is, as Senator Bonhoff indicated, right out of the PS Minnesota report. And you do have handouts with a couple of documents from the PS Minnesota report. There's the framework for a new Minnesota education funding formula that was adopted by all the members of PS Minnesota.
Well, and excuse me, Mr. Kroomquist, before you go on, I'd actually like to move the A1 amendment, which I have here, if somebody could pass that out.
We will hand that out. And
Ms. Wenzel, that's so nice of you. Thank you, sir.
We'll wait until everybody has the amendment.
Okay, very good. Sorry to interrupt, Mr. Kroomquist.
No problem.
Mr. Kroomquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And as you know, on the funding framework, the real overarching goal of PS Minnesota was to modernize and really develop a sound funding formula that has a rational link to student needs, that is based on research and supported by the data. And we definitely believe that this component meets all of those categories. The PS Minnesota report really, the three key points, and there are certainly many others, but three key points are to establish a strong base formula, to recognize individual student differences, and then to recognize individual district differences. And this piece obviously falls into that category of recognizing the individual district differences. And another one of your handouts, Mr. Chairman and members, is the one that looks like this. It takes the chapter out of the PS Minnesota report dealing with the recommendations related to addressing individual district differences. And as you will note, there are really two key pieces in there. The location cost metric, which is addressing the labor cost differential, the cost of doing business differential, then the district size adjustment, which is also related to the remoteness issue. And we, many of you probably have heard, but we ran into some problems just trying to wrestle that issue to the ground, particularly the remoteness issue and the district size adjustment really caused some issues. And quite frankly, we're going to need experts like Mr. Nauman and others to, I think, help us resolve that issue. And it's kind of why we're at a bit of a logjam right now overall in the PS Minnesota effort. And so those are two complementary pieces, the district size adjustment and then the location cost metric. Just to conclude, Mr. Chairman, we really do realize it's going to be difficult to make progress this year, but we also want community members to know that this is a vital issue, an issue that is just very important to metropolitan school districts. Right now, that labor cost differential is not addressed in the funding formula, as Senator Bonhoff indicated. In fact, the way it is met, the way that cost is met, is through the operating referendum. And the final handout in your packet, which is the one-page document, shows you just how that plays out for metro districts. And if you look, you'll see the districts that are part of the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, see what their total revenue is on a per AM.
Excuse me, Mr. Kroomquist, yes, what sheet are you on?
I'm sorry, it's a one-page handout that was in the back of that, right behind the PS Minnesota reports. In the staple, the paper-clipped packet.
Blomquist.
Okay. You'll see the ranking of how AMSD districts rank in terms of total revenue, and that's the middle column, the per AMTCU rank among all Minnesota districts. There's 339 districts. You'll see that our member districts basically rank in the middle of the pack or even lower in terms of total revenue. And if you move over a few columns under state aid per AMCPU, that's where metro districts rank in terms of the state aid they receive. So if you subtract out the levy piece, and there you will see that, in fact, metro districts rank either near or at the bottom. And then on the far right, you'll see the referendum as a percent of total revenue. And this shows you how reliant these school districts are on the operating referendum. You see many of them are at 20% or a fifth of their operating budget actually comes from the operating referendum. And as we all saw last fall, when you rely on that and are subject to the will of the voters, you're really rolling the dice. So with that, Mr. Chairman and members, I would yield to Superintendent Oslin, I believe.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Kernquist, you're saying at the bottom, but this is only, is this of the all of the school districts in the state, or is this, what grouping? Is this just the seven county metro area? This isn't all the districts there either. So when you said that you can see that your districts rank, you know, at the bottom of what?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, this list is only showing our member districts, but the rank is showing where they rank statewide among all 339 districts.
Oh, excuse me. Thank you. I missed that column.
Okay. I'm sorry. Who's going to go next?
Superintendent. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Bob Oxland, Superintendent of Schools in the Wayzata School District, and thank you for this opportunity to testify in support of Senate File 1167, Senator Bonoff's bill to include the location equity index in the funding formula. Now, I'm one of, I think, a very small cadre of educators in Minnesota who's been doing this long enough to have been a part of Minnesota education prior to the Minnesota Miracle. In fact, I think I was in about my sixth year when that event took place. And we were the first state in the nation to very proudly say, we need to have equity in education. The tax base behind a student should not determine the quality of education, et cetera. And it led the nation and still does. And since then, we've addressed equity in other ways, sparsity, economic issues, and so on. But there's still this one large factor that has not been addressed, and it is a large one. Labor costs do vary across this state, and it is more expensive in the metropolitan area to employ staff and to purchase services. And there are many studies that have shown that, the Ogden Linkenmeyer study that led up to the PS Minnesota, one of the latest. Tom Berge, who's a retired business manager in Minnetonka, who I know many of you know, collected data a year ago from the Minnesota Department of Economic Security on wage and employment. And he found that in the private sector, personnel costs in the metropolitan area were 31.7% higher than in greater Minnesota. And we know this. Those of us who have spent a good share of our lives in both in different areas across the state, those of us who still do spend great portions of our life in different areas, know that. When I need some repair work or a plumber or whatever on my house in Plymouth, the bill is going to look different than when I do the same thing on the house I own in my hometown of Walker. We know that. It's a very clear difference. And that affects schools. We have to hire those services, too. When you look actually at school personnel, from the department, we've compressed it. School personnel hourly rates are 18.2% higher in the metro area. And teacher salaries are 17.3% higher. So it's not the spread we find in the private sector, for better or worse. It's not. But it's still a significant difference, and one that really impacts the budget and really impacts the ability to provide program. And it's truly an equity issue. When I arrived in Wayzata in the summer of 2004, I came from spending a couple of years in private education where we enjoyed some very, very nice class sizes. And when I got to Wayzata and I saw the class sizes that existed, I was astounded. I was absolutely astounded. And we were a district at the cap. We couldn't move out for any. You know. Now, you've since raised the cap, which we greatly appreciated. We also appreciated the voters approving a levy about a year and a half ago. So this year we were able to drop our class sizes to at least what I would call a moderate level. Not low, certainly, but moderate. At least we don't have almost all of them in the 30s anymore. And we were able to do that because we passed a levy. But in 3 years, half of that goes away. We have to go out to the voters again. Hopefully they'll be supportive, but we know they're not always supportive of that. There's a lot of factors that weigh in on that. When you have to live from levy to levy, as was talked about earlier with the superintendent from Brooklyn Center, it's a very high-risk lifestyle, and we sure saw that last fall. But that's what we have to do with this, the labor cost differences that we face. That's our only avenue to address it. And it's time to take a look at how can we incorporate this into the formula and address this one last major equity issue. So I really urge you to do what you can do with that as we move forward. So thank you.
Okay, any questions? Yeah, Mr. Graffel.
Mr. Chair and members, I'll be very brief. I represent the Minneapolis Public Schools. I did have an opportunity to speak with Mary Gilbert, who's working the House right now, but she gave me her proxy for St. Paul Public Schools. We both support the bill, and it's quite simply labor markets exist, housing markets exist, and this bill allows us to reflect that fact in our education finance formulas. We're a little bit surprised that an effort to simplify our formulas comes up with yet another way we need to add equity into the formulas, but maybe we shouldn't be surprised that equity and fairness is complex. I think I'll just leave it at that. We support the bill. Thanks very much. Well, I guess the last point is, at a certain point, operating referenda are backfilling this labor cost differential. They're backfilling special ed cross subsidies, but really weren't operating referenda designed initially to allow us to add something extra or different than the basic educational formula. I think one of our forebears in the Senate said, you can only spend a dollar once. I think we're spending that operating referenda dollar three or four times for different supposed things, and we really lost the ability to use those referenda to the extent those of us have them for something more extra or different. We are backfilling elements of formula, basic program, that aren't present.
Okay. Thank you. And I think there will be a number of questions. One that was going through my mind is that most of the school districts that especially on the western suburban side, are kind of example type school districts. I mean, you are kind of the best of the best in terms of programs, in terms of opportunities for students. There's some districts up in my area that actually get a course from, I think it's Wayzata. And if you looked at the programs that you offer out there, they're probably about twice as many programs and opportunities as many of the small districts have. And I was thinking, shouldn't we be looking at this more in terms of opportunities for students across the whole state? I just throw that out there. Senator Scheid?
Mr. Chairman, I certainly appreciate that perspective. I don't disagree. But I don't think that the way to equalize opportunity here is to bring the top down, if you will. I mean, cause them to be in a position where they can't offer these programs. Some kind of a program for the benefit of other schools. I mean, they have been doing this since the 40s and 50s. As I mentioned, my parents were supporting every every referendum, every levy, every bond issue that came along, and it sort of set up a pattern in our family, actually. The commitment of the community to education in those western suburbs was outstanding. And I mean, I'm proud of my, you know, where I graduated to this day, almost 50 years later. So I just think that we aren't going to, we've got to bring everybody up. And I'm up to that. I've voted for tax increases over the years to do that. And maybe I'm not supposed to say that, but I have, and I would continue to do that. I just think we don't want to respond to this by holding the top level out. And I don't know that they're the best or the tops. I mean, my personal prejudice is that they are, but that's, you know, I think probably arguable. So that would be my concern. While I share your concern, I understand it completely. Yeah.
Senator Olson, and
Mr.
Senator
Chairman, to your point, that which I appreciate as well. You know, historically, many of these districts before we made changes to a particular in the property tax, and we had a very, very progressive rate structure and one that placed a heavy burden on commercial industrial. So it was very easy to pass a referendum because you weren't paying for it. Somebody else was. That's always the way it goes in terms of taxes. But I think many of these districts were model districts, and the thing that I remember having I haven't worked in the western suburbs districts, but those who did have that and were able to initiate some unique programs were always willing to share. And they provided opportunities, I think, that did extend beyond their boundaries. Your point. The other factor that variety is often a factor of size. If you've got a critical mass enough that you can, in fact, within a framework of revenue, be able to offer greater variety than you can when you have a smaller number. And I think that's the unique challenge that we have. In the rural districts, you have the blessing of smallness because you have a greater a sense of being able to, you know, of the teachers and students, I think, feeling more like family than you have when the bigness where kids can get lost in the shuffle. But by the same token, the variety has to be developed in some unique ways. And now we've got, you know, technology, we've got some other ways of doing that. And I think also, again, a willingness to share for those that have it. So I think we need to, but it doesn't rule out the fact that these, again, because the vagaries of our property tax system and our value base, where it's a commodity that has become valued, that has driven up the price, which also drives up the cost, is affecting what people need to earn it working in that area. And it's, you know, if we ignore it, we don't gain anything if we compress or bring quality down in some of our districts because of it. So it's, I hope that we can stay open to working to resolve this.
Senator Saxon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Bonif, I'm kind of interested in this whole location equity index in relationship to PS Minnesota's position. You know, whether it's you answering this or your testifiers, or even I'm sure there'll be some testifiers up with Senator Salzman's bill. You know, I'd really like to hear that be addressed a little more directly. The PS Minnesota position as it relates to this.
Mr. Chair and Senator Saxog, I think you will hear from them because, as I understand, they're not in support of this, and they'll let you know that. And that I was disappointed to hear that because I thought that this had been developed as a group. But we'll hear from them and see what they have to say.
Thank you.
And then the last thing that I would like to say with regard to this is, as you look at where these, you know, particularly the ones I represent, that was what I was looking at, as you look at where they are in the ranking, Hopkins 330th, Wayzata 336th, and Minnetonka 337th in terms of the amount of state aid they get. And so we said as a state that we were going to take over the funding of schools. And in this particular case, with the way the formula is structured, they're ending up still, you know, all three of them, with over 20% of paying on the property tax. And these districts are changing, you know, as you go out first ring, second ring, third ring, the diversity is changing. It, you know, Hopkins is the one most to the east, and they're already showing the effects of that by being, you know, in statutory operating debt. And one can assume that as things change, this won't be sustainable long term. And so that is why I'm here advocating on behalf of this.
Senator Bonhoeff, I think the indicator for education funding is really revenue and how we divide up total revenue and what total revenue a school district has to work with. So I think that's really the indicator that you have to. I mean, you can say that the property tax system is or is not fair, but it's really the amount of revenue that a school district has to work with. And I think that's the important thing.
And Mr. Chair, with regard to that point, for example, Wayzata is only 106th in terms of revenue, so they aren't in the, you know, top even 20% with regard to that either. But I hear you, and I traveled around the state, and I think that it is critical that we do something for those districts that are sparse and those districts that that have even greater needs. So I'm not here saying that we should do something for these districts in isolation. I'll tell you that. You know, I'm for doing whatever we can to level the playing field and raise the bar for everyone.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, I agree with you that when we look at the amount of state aid, that is a factor of the property values because of the equalization of both the referendum and other parts of that formula. But revenue isn't not, they're not necessarily at the top of the heap in that either.
You know, I think PS Minnesota, probably the most important component that they had was the step where the formula had to be high enough basically to fund the programs that we want to provide out there for our students. And that's the key element, I think, in terms of, because when the state bought out the formula, that was kind of the understanding, is that the formula would continue to go up. And obviously there was a misunderstanding on the part of a lot of people that this shift over to referendums as filling the gap. So I think in two areas we failed. One was in not maintaining our efforts in special education, and the other one in not maintaining our efforts in providing the formula that's needed out there. So school districts were forced basically into referendum funding, and that's caused an awful lot of heartaches out there and a lot of problems. You know, I think I hope that this committee can take a heck of a bite and move forward in those areas this year. It'll remain to be seen, but I think it's important. Senator Rubin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just kind of wanted to go back to some of the former testimony. I kind of wish you had this sheet with all the districts listed on it, because if you look at the total revenue per MPCU in the Minnesota state ranking, I think you'd find some districts just on the edge of some of these whose ranking is very near the bottom. And I agree that the schools have been willing to share and that some things can be done interactively and stuff, but we talk about what's available physically in the school. You can't really do music over interactive television, nor can you do the arts, nor can you do hands-on science for students that are interested in something like that. And if you look at these, I would be really interested in seeing the rest, because I think you'd find that bordering this are some of the lowest in total student spending, total per student spending. and they're working hard. And in my particular district, in the latest demographics, the cost of living on average is only 1% lower than the metro area, but the average wage for the district is 33% lower than the metro area. And so in some ways, adding the ranking you're suggesting would make it even worse just outside of that ring that you would create.
Senator Wergen, is there a sheet that you have that we don't have? Or
I'm looking at this one.
Oh, okay. You're looking at that one? All right.
And they, Mr. Chair, they stopped with a certain number of districts, which I understand, but what I'm saying is just outside of that, there are some anomalies that are pretty hard on the schools.
All right. Thank you. Okay, we have some other people who would like to testify.
Thank you.
Can we make a motion? Still, she's
Ms. Hasbargen?
Mr. Chair, maybe we could now move the A1 amendment. I don't think
sure.
we did that.
Senator Bonhoeff moves the A1 amendment.
And this just puts the correct numbers that PS Minnesota had in their report.
On the A1 amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. Ms. Hasbargen.
Mr. Chairman and members, I'm Vernay Hasbargen with the Minnesota Rural Education Association. And I will be referring during my testimony to handouts that look like this. And so if you would find those in your packet of papers today, I'd like to make three quick points about this bill and MREA and why MREA must oppose the bill. As Senator Bonhoeff has already pointed out, this creates a mechanism within the education funding formula that reflects labor cost differences based on the location of where you are in the state. We would argue that you don't need to create that component in the formula because it already exists in the operating levy, and that has been acknowledged by the proponents of this bill already this morning. And so what I'd like to do is just demonstrate for you why exactly we can say as an association of rural school districts that the location cost is already met through the operating levy. And the first point I'd like to make is that as the legislature has already acted on this issue, and you acted 2 years ago in the 2005 bill. That year, this bill that Senator Bonhoeff has brought forward was authored by the chair of the House K-12 Committee, Representative Sikora. And when we got down to a conference committee, it became an issue of, are we going to build the location cost or the location index into the formula, or are we going to deal with it on the property tax or on the operating levy? And the first graph here would show you what you made as a decision. You chose to raise the operating cap on the 14%. So instead of building into the funding formula a 14% advantage for districts in the metro area, you expanded the levy cap, the operating levy cap, 14%. So our first point to you today is we have already done a location cost metric. The second point is reflected on the graphs on page 2. And we have two graphs there. First, the graphs would indicate the total operating levy that exists in the suburbs, in Minneapolis and St. Paul, and then in outstate Minnesota in millions of dollars. And notice that when you add the amount of operating levy in the suburbs to what we have in Minneapolis and St. Paul, you get a total of about $425 million compared to about $200 million outstate Minnesota. That's over a 2-to-1 advantage in terms of the amount of millions of dollars raised in the operating levy. And if you notice, the number of ADMs, a number of actual pupils in those regions, is almost even. It's actually 53% to 47%. So there's a 2-to-1 advantage in terms of the millions of dollars raised over and in a differential that's almost even when it comes to the students in those two regions. And that brings me to the bottom graph, and the most important graph I want to emphasize to you today is that differential does generate $500 a pupil more in the metro area compared to the rural districts of the state on average. Already we have a $500 a pupil differential. And so we would argue that this differential is significant and it's real, and it has everything to do with educational opportunities in the classrooms of the state. In fact, I do want to address PS Minnesota's work specifically, because PS Minnesota's number one goal was to link funding to student achievement. And we know from research that the most important thing to affect student achievement is teacher quality. And yet, when you look at what a $500 a gap does to teachers' salaries, for example, I just want to say that the difference from a Hopkins to a district in Senator Stump's district is very significant. Hopkins' average teacher salary in 05 and 06 was $55,000 a year. And in Senator Stump's climax, it was $32,000 a year. That's a $23,000 differential every year of somebody's teaching career, and that gets played right into the retirements, because our teacher retirements are based on our top 5 years of income. So you've created a sort of a permanent two-tier system when it comes to quality teachers based on teacher salaries. And it doesn't stop just there, because I checked in Senator Skoglund's district, Underwood, Senator Saxhog, South Kuchiching, their average teacher salaries were $35,000. Farmington, Foley, average teacher salary, $45,000. West Tonka, Richfield, $46,000. White Bear Lake, South Washington County, $52,000. St. Paul, $52,000. So that teacher's salary gap is real and it's significant. And before we move ahead on a policy like this one that builds that kind of inequity in to the funding system permanently, we need to ask, what are we going to do when there's a teacher shortage in this state? There is already a teacher shortage in this state. What are we going to do to drive teachers to the hardest to serve classrooms? Or I will just say, already in Minnesota, we have 500 teachers teaching science on a variance. Most of them are in rural Minnesota. So already, this policy of paying teachers more in the metro area might have worked when we had a surplus of teachers. But as we head into the profound shortage that we're going to experience in a few years, it is going to be up to our policymakers to make certain that we have policies that truly drive high-quality teachers to every classroom in the state for every student. And that brings me to the final 2 pages of this handout and to the third point I want to make. Already you've done it in increasing the salary or the referendum cap. Already there's more dollars going into metropolitan classrooms. And already you have built in, through your tax policy, as you've already talked about today, an advantage that can't be overcome. This map simply shows you which districts are above average and which districts are below average when it comes to the referendum market value in those districts. This is what we base the operating levy on. And in 2001, the legislature took ag land and cabins out of this tax base and left homes and commercial industrial property. And except for a handful of rural districts, can you see which districts are above average in terms of property wealth? It's highly concentrated in the metro area. And do you know why? It's because of the high-valued homes in your tax base, as well as the commercial industrial property. So we've created almost a circular argument here that we need more money in the formula because we have higher housing costs, when really the higher-valued homes create a bigger tax base, which create more operating levy. And then that leads me to the final point I want to make, and that is that the tax reform, when you took ag land and cabins out, we have our rural districts were very, very hurt in that process, because in our smallest districts before that reform, We had a tax base on par with the metro area. Our smallest districts, our districts under 500 kids, because they were heavily egg or heavily seasonal rec, were able to compete in terms of the level of tax base. But after you took Agland and Cabins out, on average, their tax bases now are only a third of what they are in the metro area. So we lost all our buying power. Having said that, we still have in those smallest districts, those districts under 500 kids, we still have the highest operating levies, which was pointed out in some of the testimony earlier. It's because their small scale creates higher operating costs. And so on average, those smallest districts in the state have a referenda that's only $200 less on average than those metropolitan school districts. But that's not the point I wanted to make with this graph. The point I wanted to make here is what happens to the taxpayer paying in terms of paying for those operating levies, and that's the line that moves between the two bars. Because what we have here, every $100,000 of property of referendum market value in the metro area needs to pay $160 in taxes to raise that $1,075 per student. So the tax rate in those districts require $160 per $100,000 of property. Notice that for the rural taxpayer in those smallest districts, it requires $175. So the taxpayer has to pay more for per $100,000 property in order to raise $200 a student less. The point I'm trying to make here, you often hear the argument, just give us the operating levy and we'll raise our own money. There is a limitation to that in terms of the taxpayer pain, and already you have significant taxpayer pain. And that takes me back to the front page, if I might. Because, Mr. Chairman, we would argue that based on the way we equalize operating levies right now, we have built in that $500 differential, and there's nothing that we can do to change it. Because now I want to bring you over to what is current law, final bar on the right, and the pink portion of the operating levy. That is the amount that the state fully equalizes. That means that it doesn't matter if you live in Greenbush or you live in Hopkins. A taxpayer will pay the same percent of their property value for an operating levy, regardless of where you live. So this is the true equity we're after. This is the taxpayer equity. But notice, it's limited at $700. And so basically you have built in permanently that $500 differential, and the rural taxpayer and the rural student and the rural school district can't overcome it. So, Mr. Chairman, we argue you already have the location cost or equity index. It's the operating levy. But can we encourage you to do two things this year as you move forward and put together your Senate bill? First of all, let me emphasize, we might oppose the location cost metric, but we fully and completely support Senator Saltzman's bill, the PS Minnesota bill, that would pay down the special ed cross-subsidy, that would increase the formula, and that would fund all-day kindergarten. There is a complete sound consensus by the PS Minnesota players on that one. Further, we would argue that the fourth part of Senator Saltzman's bill is really the most important one, and that's the one that calls for a legislative task force to take this over and to complete the PS Minnesota work. Because the one thing PS Minnesota didn't do was get into the property tax differential at all. And we would argue there is no way that you can reform the education funding system without delving into the property tax inequities that exist. And having said that, I want to underscore two things that you're potentially going to do in your bill that we also fully, strongly, highly support. And the first is that we are going to, in the process of this year, probably in Senator Scoy's committee, do a better job of equalizing levies in the state and indexing those equalizing factors. That's absolutely crucial. And then the second thing, you heard it last week here in this committee, the consolidated levy that Senator Stumpf is working on. Not only is that consolidated levy needed to build a base of stability again, which is, I think, the argument you're using, Senator Stumpf, that it is going to create a more stable funding system, but we would argue that it begins to do what Superintendent Oslin pointed to earlier, restore the Minnesota miracle. And that is a premise that basically says it doesn't matter where you live in the state, it doesn't matter what the property wealth is of the taxpayers or the students in that district, but we all have an equal opportunity to have our education program well-funded. Senator Stumpf, we would argue that that consolidated levy is a major part of what needs to happen as we move forward with the PS Minnesota reform.
Thank you very much, Ms. Hasbergen.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonham.
I thank Ms. Hasbergen for her testimony, and it was compelling and moving testimony, and I appreciate that. And I have always respected your leadership, Mr. Chair, in terms of your commitment to fairness and the highest quality education for all of the state. And I, too, I'm actually a co-author of Senator Saltzman's bill, and I'm a strong supporter of PS Minnesota. So I'm here today not saying that we deserve, this whole bill, because I don't think that's possible in this session. I'm here today raising the importance of looking at these key factors, and I know that one of the reasons why I was elected is because the people I represent trusted that I would come to this table and fight for their interests, and that's really what I'm doing here today, because we are making tremendous cuts in these districts, and each of the districts have had cuts in the last several years, and they do have those high-cost salaries that they continue to have to negotiate, and it is difficult. So I think your point that the key to PS Minnesota is raising the bar for everyone is critical, and that you can count on me to represent the interests of those districts that I'm serving.
We also have Mr. Monteplasser. Welcome. If you could give your name for the record.
Thank you, Chairman Senator Stumpf. I'm Dr. Bruce Montplaisir, and I'm the superintendent of schools at Lewiston Altura, Minnesota. I've been involved in personnel negotiations just about every year for the last 30 years. And one of the things I found out is that if we give everybody everything they ask, the next year they will be back asking for more. So when we're involved in that negotiations process, we want to be kind of careful that that we don't build permanent kinds of expenditures with temporary revenues kinds of things. So I kind of appreciate the position that each of you is in, because I realize that's exactly what you do all the time. You've got a lot of constituents that are looking for money, and there's limited number of dollars available. Last Tuesday, I got the housing data from the Department of Revenue and ran the numbers on the Senate file 1167. And surprisingly to me, it turned out that every district in the state had an location equity index of 1. And that surprised me for two reasons. One was because that was consistent with the Legislative Auditor's Report of 1989 that studied the cost of living differential across the state. And then the other thing was that I expected that it would be more in line with Education Price Index legislation in 2001, 2003, and 2005, which proposed freezing the foundation allowance for rural Minnesota while putting in a 13.75, and a 14% increase to the foundation allowance for the 7-county metropolitan area. I didn't see this amendment A1, but if that would be consistent, my understanding would be that would be somewhere create a education price index or a location equity index of somewhere between 1.12 and 1.14 in the metro area, and that's an amount that's about $312 million to $365 million. I understand that you have a target of $498 million, and when you decide to spend money one place, you're deciding not to spend it someplace else. So if you spend it on this bill, then you're deciding not to do things like the special education cross-subsidy thing. You're deciding not all day, every day kindergarten, not the preschools. And those are things that are near and dear to me. When we wait until a child is a couple of years behind in fourth grade before we actually provide extra services to them, it takes, they've got to gain at the rate of a year and a half every year to catch up with the rest of their classmates by the time they're eighth grade. And that just isn't going to happen, I don't believe. I don't think any of the research says that's going to happen. So I think it's real important that you fund things that really make a difference for kids, knock out the achievement gaps kinds of things, things like preschool education, all day, every day kindergarten, to help all of the kids across the state, make sure that they get, especially the kids in the metropolitan area that need that help to stay even, not get behind, so they're trying to make it up at a year and a half. When I look at the revenue disparity report, I think that started about 1992-93, I see a differential from the first to the 99th percentile of about $1,300. But when I take all of the expenditures in the general funds for every school district in the state and divide that by the number of students in each school district, I get a differential in the ability to spend of $5,500 per student. You know, so there's a big difference. That just means that there's a lot of money going someplace that isn't on that revenue, isn't counted in the revenues. Okay. The other thing on the labor thing, you know, I'm living in Lewiston, Minnesota. We're 30 miles from Rochester. We compete with the Mayo Clinic for our employees. You know, and we compete with the metro area for our teachers too. By the way. Anyway. I just want to thank you for the opportunity to address this. I appreciate the work you've done, that you've been doing for the last many years. Many of you have been here as long as I have, and I know that you do the best you can for kids with the dollars that you have. So thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Montplaisir. Are there any other questions? And if not, Senator Bonhoff, would you like to make a motion?
I'm not sure, Mr. Chair. No, I move that Senate File 1167 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Okay. Senator Bonhoff moves 1167 as amended to be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the K-12 education bill. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bonhoff, and thank you, those who have testified, Senator Salzman. Oh. Okay. Say, Senator Salzman, how I see Senator Rosen is here. Would you mind if we just take her bill first?
Not a problem at all, Mr. Chair. I would be happy to defer to Senator Rosen.
I think that'll be a fairly quick bill. So I should have caught that. I'm sorry. Senator Rosen?
Mr. Chair.
Senate File 1451.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. And Senator Salzman, thank you very much for being so gracious. Before you is Senate File 1451, and basically it amends the Cooperative Secondary Facility Grant Act to a Cooperative Facility Grant Program, which will allow new cooperative facilities to qualify under the program for grants. This allows school districts that have consolidated since July 1st of 1980, or school districts that are that have not consolidated but have entered in a joint powers agreement, to receive funding for a cooperative facility grant. Mr. Chair and members, this bill has been before you last year, and we had a whole contingency of people from United South Central down in my corner of the world. They got it very early this morning, and I appreciate Kritzy Wetzel, the president of the school board, to come and testify. But basically, we worked with Senate Council and House Council and research to come up with something that is extremely important for schools out in greater Minnesota. And if you look at the co-authors on the bill, it's very, very broad. And we need to do something, and I will have Ms. Wetzel talk about that. But basically, the bill provides for grants for new facilities equal to the lesser of $20 million for approved construction cost, or if they're remodeling, for $10 million for the construction cost. So it's very, very important that we consider something like this. I can go through the changes from the 06 bill, but I think I'd like to have Ms. Wetzel speak on the condition down in United South Central.
Thank you, Senator Rosen. I'm Christy Wetzel. I'm the United South Central School Board Chair. And if I could, can I have someone please pass out the pictures of what our building looks like? And I also have a handout that I would like to share. Thank you. They're old and they're falling apart around and sometimes on top of us, as you'll be able to see from the pictures. Isn't that a horrible way to describe the buildings designed to educate our children? Welcome to school life at United South Central. These are the same buildings our children will spend hundreds of hours for 13 years of their life learning everything essential to become productive, contributing members of society. We teach them reading, writing, mathematics, and so much more in buildings the Minnesota Department of Education has deemed less than safe, according to a 2003 advisory letter. And I quote, USC's school facilities will continue to age and deteriorate, as will the environment for learning and teaching that supports students' achievement efforts and their preparation for the challenges of the 21st century. I'm here today as a mother of elementary students, a concerned citizen, and USC School Board Chair. But my most important role here today is as a representative for the voices that aren't heard, our USC students. Thank you so much for giving me this opportunity to share our needs and to show you the situation that we are faced with. Allow me to take a few minutes to give you a factual tour and explore firsthand the building issues that plague our school district and the struggles that our students face Monday through Friday, or September to June, preschool to graduation. United South Central is comprised of six unique and individual communities. The high school and elementary are located in Wells, and our middle school is located in Keister, 16 miles south. Our buildings are among the oldest, 2.7% of all school districts in Minnesota. We have 824 students. 48% of those students qualify for free and reduced price lunches. 70% of our students live in the northernmost part of our school district. Our buildings, as well as many of the buildings in your districts that you represent, have numerous educational deficiencies. Most classrooms are 33% smaller than state guidelines. 20 of our traditional classrooms are now used as special education rooms, federally and state mandated student support programs, and preschool classrooms. Our classrooms do not have space for computers, and they lack the infrastructure to support the networks and electrical needs of today's technology. We have minimal building security measures to prevent intruders from accessing student classrooms. Our structural deficiencies are numerous and include: most roofs are 20 plus years old and they need to be replaced. Our heating system is inefficient and it dates back to 1932. Our main water supply is fed through pipes dating back to 1932 and in many cases are nearly plugged with mineral deposits and they leak. Needless to say, the water is foul. Our main electric service panels use fuses and date back to the 1930s. All window panes are single-paned and drafty. Acoustic tiles often fall on top of students' heads and books. There's no safe drop-off or pickup locations for our children, as our school is located on a major highway. We have 8 pages of fire code violations representing hundreds of thousands of dollars of repairs. We've had 3 failed bond referendums. In April 2002, we proposed a $32 million new building. 25% voted yes, 75% of our voters voted no. Nearly $15 million of this referendum would have been paid through debt service equalization. In May 2005, we went back to the voters with a $24.6 million new building. 40% voted yes, 60% voted no. At that time, only $200,000 would have been paid through debt service equalization. In December of 2005, we went back with the same proposal. This time, 42% voted yes and 58% voted no. What makes our district unique? We are a consolidation of 6 communities into 1 school district. 2 communities have suffered building closings in the last 9 years, and our Keister Middle School will close in June of 2008. Our buildings are not centrally located, which adds to our open enrollment problem. 170, or nearly 20% of our students, open enroll out to other school districts, primarily because of the condition of our buildings. The city of Wells has not passed a bond referendum in over 42 years. 60% of Wells residents voted yes to referendums in both May and December of 2005. 70% of a bond for the new school will be paid by agricultural land taxes. Outside investors have caused our land values and property taxes to increase at an unrealistic rate for local farmers who purchase land for thousands less an acre. These same investors passed increased property taxes expense back onto the shoulders of the renting farmers with increased per-acre rent fees. Non-homestead agriculture would have been valued at $3,000 an acre, would have been taxed an additional $9.21 an acre for 25 years if the bond referendum had passed. The county assessor is reporting a 15% increase in ag land values from the 2006 assessment to the 2007. Under current law, USC does not qualify for debt equalization based on the inflated land values and our declining enrollment. We've done a 2-year facility study by a local group of volunteers that showed a new pre-K through 12 building on one site would cost approximately, in today's dollars, $28 million. The building was designed to meet the ever-changing dynamics of a 21st century education, and the new building is designed to be cost-effective and efficient. The minimum maintenance project on our existing buildings would cost approximately $11 million and would not address any of the educational deficiencies. The study also showed that going to one site in a new building would save approximately $350,000 a year. This would be over $9 million over a 20-year bond referendum. Senate File 1451 seeks money from the state to lower the face value of bond referendums for schools like USC. I understand that there are concerns from some legislators with this method. I am not proposing a new precedent for funding schools with bonding money. Our previous and well-respected representative, Henry Collis, who served our district for 28 years, used this very same method to bring our neighboring school district, Blue Earth Area Schools, several million dollars for a new building. On your handout, I've shared some demographic information about USC. We are here today looking for a solution. Our Constitution calls for a uniform system of public schools. If we're practicing uniformity, let me ask you, do all schools look like these pictures? Our students have to make do in a building where the drinking fountains are covered in plastic to prevent their use and forced to shower in after Fayed using water that is foul. We are a 4-star school in math and a 5-star school in English. And I often wonder what kind of educational accomplishments our students could achieve if their learning environment was conducive to their quality of work. I implore you to examine this situation and support Senate File 1451, helping USC provide a safe school able to empower our children with the tools necessary to prepare them for success for generations to come. Everyone in our communities agree we need to do something with our buildings. The truth is, we will never pass a bond referendum because of the cost to the taxpayers. Until we have some sense of equality with regard to the percentage paid by our ag landowners, USC will remain at a critical crossroads. This is truly a bipartisan issue. It's about kids. With the generous help of senators like you, USC will be able to provide a building to meet the needs of children receiving a 21st century education. Without your help, we will be forced to continue on the same path until all of our buildings are condemned and the health and the well-being of our children is jeopardized. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony and for the pictures. Members, we do have, a method of what we're going to do with this bill. And it's also, there's Senator Kubley has a bill, and there's a request for some technology money. And so I think what we should do is to submit a letter to the Capital Investment Committee, and that's what they're asking anyway. And we would also include those three proposals as a request, And I think all of them could be used for one-time expenditures. I mean, the money for it could be used. And then that would go to, actually, it would go to Senator Cohen, the chair of the Finance Committee. And that's what he has requested, too. So if that would be all right. Senator Robler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I find the testimony amazing when you think about $9 an acre on farmland. So if you have a 500-acre farm, it's $4,500 in additional taxes. Or if you have 1,000, which isn't uncommon in your area at all, you're talking about $9,000 a year increase. I can see why they can't pass these. I think of how often we pass bond referendums in my area. Almost every other year right now. We're building new schools every other year. And, you know, there would be no way we could ever pass something like that if that was the result of the people who had to pay the bill. Because you just can't come up with that much extra money in any single year. And then to do it year after year for 20 years.
No, it's a real problem out there. So, Senator... Senator Roebling, would you like to move?
Mr. Chair, may I just say
one thing, Senator
please?
Roebling.
Thank you. First of all, thank you, Senator Roebling. The USC is truly the poster child for what's some of the dire situations going out in greater Minnesota, as you can tell by the co-authors on the bill. It has been discussed in several meetings off campus in various areas with I-90 groups and greater Minnesota legislators on what we have to do. And I will just tell you very quickly, Mr. Chair, members, that the first time I took an in-depth tour of United South Central, I thought, oh, this school can't be that bad. It's really, really bad. But it is a five-star school. And the communities cannot attract jobs if they don't have the number one issue that people come to a school for and that or come to a city for, and that's quality of education. And the building site, a safe building site. So that's why I'm very passionate. We're both very passionate, and I want to thank her for her hard work. I do have a little oral amendment that was brought up to me by Mr. Tom Deans on page 5, line 35, held in conjunction with the annual election, and he pointed out that perhaps should be general election, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Page 5, line 35.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the amendment. I think it should be general.
Thank you, Senator Rowland.
Okay. Just a second while Mr. Nauman visits with Mr. Deans. There will be, members, there will be one other amendment that we don't have drafted yet, but that would be instead of state bonding authorization, we'd be using one time. The request would be for one time money, so we'd have to redo the language in section 5. Okay,
Mr. Chairman, just to clarify the point, I think the proper amendment would be to strike annual and insert general.
Senator Roebling moves that on line page 5, line 5.35, delete annual and insert general. On that amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. Okay, Senator Roebling.
Mr. Chair, I would move that Senate File 1451 be laid over for consideration in the omnibus K-12 finance bill.
Yes, I think that's that. The amendment would be Senate File 1451 as amended would be laid on the table. What we would do then would be to submit a letter to the Finance Committee for the one-time money for that. Okay. On Senator Roebling's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. Thank you very much,
Senator Roebling. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members Roebling, Senator Salzman, and members. Okay.
And Senator Salzman, thank you.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. I'm here today with Senate File 1232, And if today's testimony and the testimony from the last few months as we have listened to the needs of school district has not made it very apparent that it is time for us to reform our school funding formulas. And PS Minnesota has been before this committee before and has talked about the efforts that have been made over the past 3 years to bring forward a new funding model. But today, Senate File 1232 is being proposed as the interim solution of what we can do in the 2007 session to address this issue. So at this time, I would like to move forward Senate File 1232. With me today are people who represent PS Minnesota, and what I want to emphasize here is that what is so critical about this bill is that it represents what many different education groups have done to address this issue. And I want to thank Senator Bonhoff today for bringing forward what is really another important issue here, that we have problems across the state. Our school funding formula is broken, whether it be in Wayzata, Princeton, Stillwater, Grand Rapids, Roseau, McGregor, Eagan, or Minneapolis. Our school funding formula is not serving our students. And school districts are having to deal with these issues in many different ways. In our suburban areas, I look at my own school district in Stillwater, where a school district levy failed. My concern is, what if that levy fails again this year? And not only do we fail on a new referendum, but we are unable to renew our existing levy. There could be a crisis in our school districts on November 10th, the day at whenever this next election is, if some of these referendums fail, because school districts are cutting, and they are cutting significantly from our classrooms. There is a growing reliance on our operating levies, and so the PS Minnesota model really addresses the fact that we need to create a more stable and equitable and also adequate formula for our public schools. Senate File 1232 has four components, essentially, and there will be speakers talking to each of these. The first piece, as has been mentioned already, is to address special education. The second piece is to address the phase-in of voluntary all-day kindergarten. The third piece is to address a formula increase. And that fourth piece, which is so critical and requires our courage, is to call together a task force to truly have a serious discussion. What I have seen happen within our hearings is that we talk about one bill or another bill, and we really need to sit down and to sit down with our House members and also members of the Department of Education and have a thoughtful discussion of how we are going to fix school funding in Minnesota. So at this time, I would like to start by calling on Annalise Arrow, who is a kindergarten teacher at Lake Elmo School in the Stillwater School District. And you have before you a yellow piece of paper. And before she begins her testimony, this is hot off the press. So I would like you to turn to the second page. And if you look at lines 6 and 7, you're going to see on lines in columns D, E, and F, line 6 represents students who have participated in Stillwater's all-day voluntary kindergarten program for the past 5 years. And you're going to see the difference between line 6 and 7 in test scores for those students who before them only had a half day of kindergarten. So you can see it. We've been able to document an increase in testing scores as a result of those students who have been in all-day kindergarten versus half-day. And then you move down to lines 19 and 20, and again you can see the difference between students who have been in all-day kindergarten and now have progressed 5 years, who are now in fourth grade, and those students, the last group of students, who are in a half-day of kindergarten. I'm not an expert in test scores, but it appears to me that there is a clear, significant difference in the test scores of children who have participated in that all-day kindergarten program. So at this time, I would like to call on Annalise Arrow.
Hi. This is my 18th year in the district, in the Stillwater School District, and my 18th year teaching kindergarten at Lake Elmo School. And I want to thank you for letting me come and talk about all-day, because I'm very passionate about it. And the first 14 years, I taught a half-day kindergarten program. It was a good program. The kids came and left after 2.5 hours. We did lots of fun projects. They learned their ABCs and sounds, or they tried to. A few of my students would be reading and writing comfortably by the end of the year. This is my fourth year teaching all-day kindergarten, and yes, I had major apprehensions about the concept of five-year-olds staying all day, the academic rigor of an all-day program, the sheer physical exhaustion the children and I would probably feel, the idea of a five-year-old having to be responsible for learning a lunch number, interacting with the whole school on a daily basis, and many other fears. Well, my fears have disappeared. I am an all-day kindergarten believer. The children I see today really need the challenges that all-day kindergarten provides. All of my children are reading by the end of the year. In the past, perhaps a quarter of my students would be reading. Just the other day, a first-grade teacher commented to me that her students are at the reading level in September that they would have been by January in a half-day program. Kindergarten teachers are able to spend more time exploring content areas thoroughly while still having time for those traditional kindergarten activities. We always felt restrained by not enough time to do everything. All-day kindergarten has given kindergarten teachers the gift of time to meet the academic, social, and emotional needs of all of our students. This time with my students has made a huge difference in their academic success. And an expression that I heard and one that echoes in my mind is that all-day kindergarten torques the system. All-day kindergarten provides a strong base for future school experiences. And going back to a half-day program would be a big step back for our district. And for that reason, I'm here to advocate the benefits of an all-day kindergarten program for all the children in Minnesota. And I know your time is limited, but I'm going to share a few stories. Kindergarten teachers love to tell little stories that illustrate the benefits of an all-day program. And yesterday, when I found out I was coming here, I had a parent who I told, and she left a message on my phone. She was so excited I was coming. And she was a difficult parent because she had homeschooled one of her children and had finally sent him to our school. And she was very worried about an all-day program. And she'd looked at private schools and was very concerned about it. And now, she said, he has bloomed so much. He has grown so much academically. I can't even believe that I ever was even worried about having him in an all-day. That's what I would suggest for all children. A first-grade teacher shared with me that in her reading group, she has the highest reading group. The kids that are coming in from other schools who are in half-day programs frequently wind up in the lowest reading groups. They're just not prepared, and they need lots of time to catch up to the other kids in her class. And that's the beauty of all day. It benefits all children from the highest to the lowest. They receive the extra time and instruction they need to receive. The top kids get stimulation. The lowest kids get support and mentoring. And the middle shows consistent improvement. Now, here's a problem with all day. It's not really a problem. It's a wonderful problem. The first and second grade teachers tell me that they are scrambling to find more advanced materials for their students. Boo-hoo. It's exactly the kind of problem that we hope continues in those grades. And finally, a first grade teacher noted to me that her kids are coming in so much more confidence, with so much more confidence and maturity, and a skills base that was impossible coming from a half-day program. And as I mentioned at the beginning, I was a skeptic, and now I see that all-day kindergarten jumpstarts the academic success of our children and continues to improve their performance for years to come. And Stillwater District understands the important difference all-day kindergarten can make in the lives of its students. And I am hopeful that the state of Minnesota will also be convinced that all of its children would benefit from an all-day program. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Arrow. And Senator Saxog has a question.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Is it Ms. Arrow?
Yes.
What type of preparation do the kids that come into all-day kindergarten have? I mean, is there a lot of...
You mean
of
their back room?
Yeah.
Some are in preschools. Yeah.
Can you really tell the difference, or tell me how that reaction... I mean, how that affects what you do and how they improve.
Well, it does affect. Those kids are much more ready to start reading and writing than the other kids. And the kids who get the stimulation at home with the parents reading to them, they get, but what's nice is with all day, it helps the other kids also catch up because they're with me all day. I mean, they're just bombarded with print and books, and it's just fabulous.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Robley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How much are your students paying for all-day kindergarten? Or your families of the students? Because it's voluntary, right?
Senator Saltzman.
Yes, Madam Chair and Senator Robley. Stillwater School District made a decision 5 years ago to fund all-day kindergarten. But there was an expense to that, in that in trying to save money on transportation, our secondary school day was cut in the number. I think 45 minutes was cut off our secondary school day. We did a different transportation model. And there was some cost savings in terms of that a bus did not have to return students during the half day. So they tried to bring all that together. But there is a cost, and that the Stillwater District at this point has made the decision to fund all-day K. It's one of the only school districts in the state who was doing it at no cost to parents. So the district has made the right decision, and that's why I think it's really important to look at the PS Minnesota model, which phases in the weighting of kindergarten students. We don't have enough money. I'd like to think we have enough money this year to do all-day kindergarten. It truly impacts students, as we have heard and seen. But I think that the reality is there a way to phase in the weighting to encourage schools to do this? That would be my suggestion. Stillwater School District does not have a large operating levy. I think our operating levy, you know, compared to the metro area, is around $860. So it has been done at the expense of other programs.
Well, we would applaud the Stillwater District for taking that important step. I wasn't aware that they fully subsidized it.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
I just want to go back to this yellow sheet because I am still a little confused by what the DEFG means up at the top. And we were looking at the D and E in the sixth and seventh column.
I'm Senator Roebling.
Senator
and
Saltzman.
Madam Chair, I am not an expert in this. Like I said, it's hot off the press, but it's my understanding that the D, E, F, and G would be D would be for second grade testing, E would be for third grade testing, and F would be for fourth grade testing. So if you go down to row 6 in column F, that is the fourth grade score, and that's the first – the row 6 is the group of students who were the first group of students to be in all-day K. They did not test them in kindergarten and first grade. They started testing in second grade. So D is for second grade test scores, E is for third grade test scores, and F is for fourth grade test scores. So row 6 is that first the class of 2015, you can see their test scores compared to row 7, which is the last group of students who had half-day kindergarten. Is that helpful?
I'm still a little confused there, because then I'm not seeing a significant change in test scores.
Senator Saltzman.
Madam Chair and Senator Rowling, I am not a test expert, and I understand that this is a statistically significant difference, but I do not have someone here from my district to talk about this, but they did send this to us to demonstrate some of the information that they're gathering on test scores. And that the you can see that in row D, the class of 2017, 16, and 15 have consistently had higher scores than those students in the class of 2014 and 13 who had a half-day kindergarten.
Senator Wieger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I wanted to point out a neighboring district, North St. Paul, Maplewood, Oakdale, has voluntary all-day kindergarten, and it doesn't charge either. And they're in a deficit, but they did it because parents would decide, we're not going to stay in your district or move to the district, and it's become a very important real estate as to whether you're going to be in a community or not. So I just want to underscore how important it is for people in planning, and a value that the school board, like the Stillwater board, had to approve just to be responsive to the needs of parents.
Thank you, Senator Wieger.
This time I'd like to call on Greg Vondell, who is sort of the convener of PS Minnesota, and if he would introduce his other testifiers today.
Thank you, Senator Saltzman. Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to come back to you today. You introduced me as a convener, and sometimes I feel like a marriage counselor. I've said that here before. Because we have sometimes a widely disparate group, and each of these individuals who are at the table on my left and on my right represent the Executive Committee for PS Minnesota, and Mary Ciccone from Parents United, Brand Laudell for Schools for Equity and Education, Sam Walseth from Minnesota Rural Education Association, and Scott Kroonquist from the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. I would hope you'd indulge me for just a second, because I need to make certain that, people understand and enter into the record who comprises PS Minnesota. We've heard PS Minnesota's name bandied about quite a lot this morning. The Association of Metropolitan School Districts, Isaiah Grip, Lake Country Service Co-op, Lake Superior Area Schools, Minnesota Administrators of Special Education, Minnesota Association of School Administrators, Minnesota Association of School Business Officials, Minnesota Association of Secondary School Principals, the Minnesota Elementary School Principals Association, the Minnesota Parent Teacher Association, the Minnesota Rural Education Association, the Minnesota School Boards Association, the Minnesota School Public Relations Association, Northeast Service Co-op, Northwest Service Co-op, Parents United for Public Schools, Resource Training and Solutions, Schools for Equity and Education, South Central Service Co-op, Southeast Service Co-op, and Southwest West Central Service Co-op. Nearly 20 different organizations, and I appreciate you listening through that, but it's important to understand that we represent almost all of the major education associations, especially on the management side and on the organizational side, the administrative side in the state of Minnesota. This has been an effort vested in a total reform of the funding formula, and no better argument could be made for the need to take a total approach than the argument made this morning in this very room as you considered one component part. Senator Bonhoeff, you suggested that PS Minnesota might oppose the bill that you entered into the record just a short time ago. In fact, the organization has taken no position on your bill. But we have taken one position that might find ourselves in both concert and contrary to your bill, and that is that we would suggest that an LCM is a part of a total solution, but a part, not the part. Just the same, we would endorse a small school formula that truly addresses the differences that take place. In fact, what we hope we can accomplish over the course of time is the total reformation of a system of funding schools that is not vested in student needs. It is not tied to sufficiency or adequacy. It's not tied to student performance. And you've heard our, actually, 2 days of testimony on this very issue. We'd like to talk a little bit about what it is we are all about. We have, I believe, Scott, you distributed a little bit earlier the framework that should be in front of you. You recognize that framework is rationally determined. It is vested in data. It is based on the notion that there's a better way to fund our schools. It moves away from a reliance on operating referenda. It is a system of funding schools that is tied to student needs, and it acknowledges individual differences. It's tied to district needs, and it acknowledges individual district differences. We believe that with continued work, we can find a solution to the funding problem that will address many of the concerns that were raised this morning. Frankly, it's a move away from a referendum. I heard both the proponents and the opponents to the Bonhoeff bill talk about the referendum as being the mechanism that either solves the problem or creates the problem. In fact, we could recognize that the referendum is a culprit, and the referendum needs to move out of the central part of the formula and more onto the peripherals. And as you recognize, our formula framework really suggests that the referendum should be used for extras as opposed to for the fundamentals. The bill that Senator Saltzman has laid before you is, in fact, endorsed by PS Minnesota, and we appreciate the opportunity to have it be heard. I would argue, and this isn't my vernacular, this is, I think, my esteemed colleague to the right suggested yesterday, that it might be described as PS Minnesota light. It is not the entire formulation. It's not the entire framework. Perhaps the calorie count of the entire framework was too much for anybody to be able to digest in one fell swoop. So what we've done is we've fallen back to what we consider to be the most critical elements for now. But what we're hoping is that as we move forward, that the formulation that we've represented to you will become in total a part of Minnesota's funding framework. One very important part of this is the task force. And I'm here to suggest that we're not looking for task force light. We're not looking for simply a group of individuals that come together and pay lip service to this challenge. What we really would hope would happen is that if this bill moves forward, that a task force is empowered to make recommendations that would have some binding authority on this body, that would come back and be given due consideration and would be entered into the record. Because if the task force merely moves forward paying lip service and gets entangled in some of the political convolutions and no good legislation emerges, then we have misstepped as a PS Minnesota coalition. And our misstep would have been, instead of bringing you a solution in sum total, we would
Mr.
have worked
Vandel,
with you instead.
If I could just interrupt you at this moment, I would say that there might be some discussion around whether that is the configuration that is the one that we would want to go forward with. We appreciate you putting that forward, and it may be that we would suggest another approach, and we could work with Senator Saltzman on that at another time.
Madam Chair, in fact, we're hoping to work with you throughout this process. That really is our deep desire. What I would ask at this moment in time is if you would allow the different individuals that represent the executive committee to speak to different component parts of the Saltzman bill and give it consideration. We believe that it's worthy of consideration and adoption. Thank you.
And Mr. Vandel, thank you for commenting on the PS Minnesota being neutral on my bill. That wasn't what I experienced sitting at the table from other members, so I appreciate that comment. Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members. My name is Mary Ciccone, and I'm with Parents United. And one of the things that Parents United does is talk with parents every evening about schools and school funding. From Frazee to Jackson County Central, I was at Stillwater last night. And what we've learned is that parents are tired. Parents are very tired. They're tired of the cuts, but they're also tired of the levies. And it's just important to remember that prior to 1990, less than half of the school districts in the state had levies in place. That number today is 90%. 90% over the last decade. But more importantly, the local levies make up 18% of a school district's budget, 18%. These levies are now paying for cross-subsidy, they're paying for paper, they're paying for crayons, they're not paying for extras. Parents get this, and they're very tired. And Parents United is here because it's obvious that this formula needs reform. The bill that you have in front of you provides you an opportunity to change this direction. It provides some immediate relief. It provides an investment in the future with its beginning for all-day K, but more importantly, it provides you with time for the substantive conversations that need to take place. This morning, you were having some of those substantive conversations, but what are tax ramifications of any change that you might make, whether it be the Bonhoeff bill or not? What is free and reduced lunch the correct proxy for at-risk? How are we going to keep small schools viable? When I go to Frazee, what can I tell them? They're fearful of losing their entire district. And are there regional cost differences? And if there are, how should they be dealt with? All of this takes legislative conversation. As a coalition, I need you to know that PS Minnesota has succeeded in securing substantial grant dollars.
And why we have is to be in front of the public, talking about the present funding formula and the need for reform. That's what we're doing. We're out every day talking about this. But we're working throughout the state, but we need you. We can get folks interested, but we need you to help make the decisions. And we need you to take on this issue, because ultimately you will be the architects of a new Minnesota miracle. And please move forward with this.
Thank you, Ms. Ciccone.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Brad Lundell. I'm the Executive Director of Schools for Equity and Education, and I'm also very glad to be in front of you today and speaking in favor of Senate File 1232, which is authored by Senator Saltzman. I'm not a big fan of Dr. Phil, but I've always thought that one of the things that I've always thought he had a good saying was the get real challenge. And I think one of the things we've tried to do here in PS Minnesota is to really get real, to understand that there is a gap between what the needs of the school districts throughout the state truly are, and then put together a funding system that it adequately and equitably is going to address what those true needs are. And I think that that has been what the effort here has been, and I would, you know, echo the comments that have been made by Superintendent Vondell and Ms. Sconi. We need legislative investment in this, and this is how we see in all of these elements places for the legislature to weigh in, and especially again on the task force issue. Some people were disappointed that when we came to the legislature this year, they say, well, how come you didn't come up with the formula? And I was I'm pretty good at writing formulas, and as many people are at this table are good at writing formulas, but the problem is our formulas really have no basis in the true politics that plays in. And I don't view politics as a dirty word, and I don't view school politics as a dirty word as well. It's very much prevalent in what we do, and we need to have those elements balanced out as we move forward. We view the task force, and however you configure the task force, we view that opportunity to exchange what we believe to be the true needs of school districts and what those visions are, and to move toward policy solutions that aren't going to work for 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, but really set a basis for Minnesota for the next 35 years, as the Minnesota Miracle has done for us now. I'd like to just diverge a little bit talking about why we need the general ed formula, and Senator Stump talked about this, why we need the general ed formula to be a greater reflection of the average cost as opposed to the minimum cost. I think we see it not just today, but every day that this committee meets. People come in with a bill that fiddles with a dial here or there and says, we have this special need. Please fix this special need for us. Please, you know, fix the compensatory formula, the equity formula, the sparsity formula. And there's all this fiddling with the dials that goes on. And what we get out of that, all that fiddling, is this image that we're all so different here in Minnesota, that the children are all so different. My argument is that the children are a lot more the same than they are different. We need to have avenues for districts to deal with their special needs and their special circumstances. But we need to get the general ed formula back to a level that is more reflective of the average cost of educating a child as opposed to the minimum cost. Because whenever that happens, whenever we get closer to the minimum, every time something happens in the district, whether it's declining enrollment or growing enrollment, whatever it will be, the effect, the size of the rock going into the puddle, is a lot larger. The ripples are going to be a lot more violent. We need to have a general ed formula that gives districts more room to move, and then on top of this higher general ed formula, really use categoricals and adjustments to zero in on really explicit problems as opposed to problems that most every district in the state may be experiencing. So I'll leave my comments at that, and surely we'll be able to, or certainly open to questions later.
Thank you, Mr. Lundell.
Madam Chair, members, thank you, Madam Chair. Sam Walsh with the Minnesota Rural Education Association. I basically want to reiterate the testimony that's been stated here today, but maybe just to go back a little, a few years, to really talk about the need for adequacy. In 2001, which was my first year at the Capitol here, so you can blame all of this on me, we adopted the big plan, which was part of the deal with Governor Ventura. And it was a state takeover of the general education levy with the promise and commitment that the state will adequately sustain funding for the learner components for education here in Minnesota. Unfortunately, 1 year after adopting that big plan, the state went into a massive recession. We ended up with a $4.5 billion deficit. We received zero and zero on the basic formula allowance. And according to former Revenue Commissioner Matt Smith, who was arguably the architect of that big plan, at a forum this last fall, he indicated that the majority of new revenue to schools is now derived from local property taxes. That's an unfortunate situation. All the legislation you've reviewed this morning point to the problems, as Superintendent Vondell indicated, the culprit of the operating referendum. The quote from the superintendent from Brooklyn Center, I just wanted to highlight that. He said on the bill about getting out of statutory operating debt, he said, "With a little luck, we'll pass a referendum and we'll get out of this mess." Madam Chair, members, we shouldn't be mortgaging student education opportunities on a little luck. We should do the serious work. And as Brad said, get real about this and take the challenge and say, no, not with a little luck are we going to finance student opportunities. With adequate state funding and a stable revenue base, we're going to finance education opportunities for kids. So, Madam Chair, excuse me, and members, just like to reiterate the comments that have been made today and say MREA supports the bill before you and the need for a task force work to look at specific formula constructs to fill in the gaps in the other parts of the formula. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Kroonquist.
Madam Chair, Scott Kroonquist, AMSD. I think we are rapidly approaching that point in the hearing where everything's been said, but not everyone has said it. With that, I want to just reiterate our support for Senator Salzman's bill, thank her for bringing it forward, and especially emphasize the legislative commission that's created in that bill and really the need to move that forward and continue to iron out the remaining wrinkles in the PS Minnesota report. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Clark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to thank you all for the work that you've done on this. Clearly, we've got a ways to go before we figure everything out. I think one of the things that we've had in common, too, I keep bringing up Senate File 3, which is also trying to help us with eliminating the achievement gap, et cetera. And a component we haven't talked about much recently happens to be the all-day kindergarten part. And clearly, if we're serious about closing that, hopefully before kindergarten, we need to make sure somewhere along the way within all of this that we don't have kids going backwards. So I just want to thank you for that and knowing that we do need to figure out over time how to phase that in. One question I do have, though, on the task force is on page 5, before the task force, on line 5.6, and then within the task force, it does have not only the standard but an index, and that seems like that presupposes perhaps what the task force will come up with. And so I guess I question that maybe we got an upfront, I hate to use the word bias because that has a negative connotation, but it sounds like you may already have some thoughts about what we should be doing there, and so that's just a question as we move forward.
I'm going to move that to some of the framers of our bill. Brett Lundell, Scott Kroonquist.
Mr. Lundell.
Madam Chair, Senator Clark, one of the frustrations that has been in place over the years is that the foundation amount does not have an inflator in it. Should we have to come back to the legislature? Basic form. There is some concern on the PS Minnesota side if that inflator is just built into the system that that would alleviate that. It's something that has come through the system. Having worked on that side of the table, I know that the reluctance to put those kinds of things into law is clearly there. And oftentimes I see my friends from the Department of Finance are probably ready to jump over.
Well, Madam Chair,
Clark.
Certainly, I mean, one of the things we've been grappling with this whole session is that we have forecasts that include not just projected revenue increases, but also forecasts that include projected expenses that go up. So I think, you know, along those lines, there certainly is some agreement that we need to be taking into account what real cost increases are. I think one of the concerns that I'd at least have is ultimately under this approach, I mean, who's going to end up doing a fair amount of the work of playing around with these numbers? Because my concern would be if it's our internal staff that will do it, we may not actually have enough time to do it. We kind of went into this crunch this year. And is your thoughts that you will continue to have people available to be helping? I mean, the more complicated this is, the more time it takes. So are you going to continue to have some ability to provide some of that work? No, whether there's indexing or not, and yes, you've hit the nail on the head. I figured that finance would end up saying something if I didn't. So.
And Senator Clark, just a moment. Just, I think you raised some good points, and Chair Stumpf does have some of those concerns and has some thoughts about the inability for staff to play that role, and perhaps there are some other ideas.
Yeah, so I think as you're going on, you don't have to address it right now because I know we're coming in near the end of our time, but it's something for us to keep talking about because sometimes when we need to be making a significant or want to look at significant changes, we can get beyond, even if we've got really smart brains, the capacity from a hours in the day standpoint. So.
Mr. Lindell.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Clark, I'm always willing to help.
That's good. I'm glad for the record you're willing to help. That's good.
And then also on Senator Clark's point about the formula allowance, it does build in that cost of or the inflationary costs beyond the biennium, which we don't traditionally do, and so that probably is something we would have to look at.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Weaker.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator Saltzman, and everyone for your work, and I'm sure there'll be a task force this summer. I just wanted to throw out for your consideration as well a proposed task force that I'm going to be advocating, and not on this bill, but it would relate to it. Many of us talk about a P16 system, and I obviously want stability in all of the systems, and particularly your focus. But in this committee and others, we've talked continually about early education, about early identification, intensive intervention, cost savings through the system. And I ask that we be thinking down the road for possible modifications in the system that would look more formally at early education as well as higher education. And I think the overlap is obvious to most of us. So I wanted to just put that on the record for your reflection as we move ahead.
Thank you, Senator Weaker.
Madam Chair, Senator Weaver, as you recall from the presentation we made about a month ago, we framed our current work based on the Governor's Task Force work, and that was restricted to a K-12 approach. We remain open to discussions of early education and post-secondary education, certainly, because we recognize that we are we're linked, and the fate of our children depends upon a comprehensive approach. Yes.
Anybody else wish to testify at this time in support or in opposition to this bill? Mr. Lindell.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, just to point out the when we look at the special ed, there's some differentiation in the special ed formula here. It's a special ed formula that's been with growth factors and the like. One big difference here is that we are going at 65% of salary and benefits as opposed to the current law, 68% of salaries. So there is an additional cost tag here, a price tag beyond what is currently in law for special education. I just didn't want people to get lost in that. This does go to a more full reimbursement of special ed costs statewide. It would reduce the cross-subsidy even more, but would not eliminate the cross-subsidy. That will still be there, but it will certainly be a much smaller cross-subsidy.
Thank you. So at this point, Madam Chair, if there are no other questions, I'd like to move forward. Senate File Number 1232. Senator Saltzman. Senator Stumpf has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just on the task force and who's going to set it up and who's going to do the work, Was there any discussion about the task force?
Senator Stumpf, I did let people know that we did have some thoughts about that and that we would work with Senator Saltzman with regard to the role of the staff in that and that perhaps you had some other ideas. Anything you'd like to share about that?
Well, I think that we probably should, you know, I'd be in favor of putting an appropriation here to fund it. And I just don't think it's right to have our Senate staff do the work. I think we should, you know, or can expect the Senate staff to do the work. I think we should probably put some money into it and then have it put out on an RFP or something.
So does that, talking to Madam Chair, and Senator, I would be very supportive of that. I believe it's in the bill as a placeholder to start the discussion that there is a tremendous need to have further study and discussion. And I believe it needs to involve legislators so that we can have the discussion that sometimes we have at this table on individual pieces of this, but to be able to participate and become educated through the process of what it takes. So if there are additional resources and to identify who those people or resources may be, I'd be very, very open to that. And I really appreciate your support of that proposal.
Madam Chair, Senator Stumpf, I would suggest on behalf of PS Minnesota that this would be consistent with an approach that we attempted to undertake before we were PS Minnesota, when we were just this funding study working group. We really stood before this committee in the past and asked for assistance in completing the governor's task force work by looking for an appropriation. Naturally, we would wish to know who's doing this work, and we want to make sure it's vetted appropriately. There needs to be authenticity. There needs to be a research approach that's valid. But with all of those things in mind, we're very interested in this.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Being a member of the State and Local Government Committee, where we are always reviewing task force, there's a couple of things that Senator Ress will surely be looking for in this. I don't see a convening authority, although you could easily make that the Commissioner of Education. And then, of course, money to cover, or will they be doing this at no additional cost? Somewhere it has to state one or the other. And the tasks are pretty well laid out, I think. And then also when the task force would conclude its work, and it looks like you sort of have a concluding date with the report, but just to make it clear when the report is submitted, the task force would be dismissed. So I know those are all things that she requires, and I just want to give you a heads up because she may call this in because it has a task force.
Senator Roebling, on that point, I think we are premature because we are going to be doing some work on how we might go forward. So I think that at this point the intent is to lay this over and consider it as part of the omnibus bill and perhaps a different structure than an official task force.
Okay.
Senator Stumpf, would you concur?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Very good.
And just another comment, Madam Chair, from Dr. Vondell.
Madam Chair, we heard PS Minnesota referenced several times this morning, and I appreciate those references. On the one hand, it offers legitimacy to a strong coalition. On the other hand, it's a touch dangerous because we want to make certain as a coalition that as legislation moves forward, it is in fact connected to our total mission. I would encourage you to consider a comprehensive approach to any education legislation you might undertake. And if you in fact want to vet it through PS Minnesota, please ask us, and we can and will take positions on things like that. But I would counsel you or caution you not to simply assume that if some entity sits before you and says this sounds like it may be in concert with PS Minnesota, that it isn't automatically a PS Minnesota initiative. This that is before you today is the PS Minnesota initiative. And we, in fact, are interested in much more, but that additional effort should emerge through the work of a task force that's held in conjunction with this austere body. We support this bill. We would hope that we move forward with this bill and enact a total legislative solution.
Thank you. At this point, then, when are we doing?
Senator Saltzman, you have a motion?
Yes. Madam Chair, I would like to move forward Senate file number 1232 for possible inclusion, to be laid over for possible inclusion in the E-12 Omnibus Education Finance Bill.
So moved. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carried. Meeting is adjourned, and we will convene tomorrow morning at 8:30.
Senator Saltzman.
Thank you.